Support for this podcast comes from Microsoft Surface. Now more than ever, you need a laptop that can be as adaptable as you are. Introducing Microsoft Surface Laptop Go. Finally, a premium laptop at an affordable price. Starting at just $549, its light, thin design, vibrant touchscreen, powerful processor, and built-in HD camera and mic turns any room in your home into a classroom, office, or study hall. Available in three amazing colors the whole family will love. Visit surface.com/laptopgo for more details.
We're bringing this medicine to the community because we really think that it will work. And we've seen that it's been working and helping white people for decades, and people of color haven't had a chance to partake of it.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the 730 Podcast, and I'm your host, Wally White. The reason we call this the 730 Podcast is because in the 90s song Ebonics, the late, great Big L raps,
"If you 730, that means you crazy.
Some might call me 730. I was recently hospitalized and diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and I'm trying to make sense of an issue both for myself and my audience that's too often misunderstood. I'm not a mental health expert, but I'm here to engage mental health professionals, athletes, artists, and other cultural influencers in conversations that explore how trauma and mental illness intersect with Black culture. I recently talked with Dr. Monica T. Williams. She is a board-certified licensed clinical psychologist and the clinical director of the Behavioral Wellness Clinic in Tallinn, Connecticut. She is also the associate professor in the School of Psychology at the University of Ottawa. She provides individual psychotherapy as well as consultation, supervision, and training to clinicians for empirically supported treatments. She trains clinicians in exposure and ritual prevention, prolonged exposure, behavioral activation, functional analytic psychotherapy, and cultural competence. Her acumen in this space is vast. She's written several books on equity and cultural responsive care. She is absolutely brilliant. People are often asking me, how am I getting people on the podcast? How do I select guests and things like that? And how I found out about Dr. Williams was I was talking to another therapist who was aware that I was doing the podcast, and he endorsed Monica Williams very strongly and suggested that she was one of the biggest names and people that I needed to get on the podcast. So me being the podcast dreamer, I thought I'll look into this woman and find out about some of the work she's doing. So I like to think of Dr. Williams as one of the more radical mental health professionals I've had the luxury of speaking with. She's been a strong proponent of getting more people of color to participate in clinical trials. And she's also been a supporter of the use of psychedelics in treating PTSD. So we had a really good conversation, and here it is. I was wondering if you could briefly introduce yourself, like who you are, what you do, and maybe what some of your research focuses on primarily.
Sure. So my name is Monica Williams, and I originally am from California, and have traveled widely across the country for my career and my education, and recently have ended up north of the border in Canada. So I'm the Canada Research Chair for Mental Health Disparities at the University of Ottawa. And I study, well, broadly mental health disparities, but specifically certain conditions and as they apply to people of color. So some of my big research areas have been post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and other anxiety related conditions. And I'm really interested in how experiences of race, racialization, racism, discrimination impact the way these different disorders look and our ability to get help for them.
I know you say you're from California. How did all this come about in terms of you making your way up to Canada and the University of Ottawa?
Yeah, so you know, I study clinical psychology, and it's a very competitive field. It's really kind of hard to get into graduate school. So when people apply, they apply usually all over the country, and really kind of have to go where they get in because it's really hard. And so this is actually, I think, a problem because there are so few clinical psychologists of color, in part because of a lot of the barriers to even just getting in the field. So then there aren't enough of us to treat people of color who need help for the most complicated conditions. And then also as psychologists, we're designing the treatments that mental health practitioners everywhere are using. And so there aren't enough of us to make sure that these treatments are appropriate for people of color. So that's how I ended up traveling, just because it was really important to me. It was kind of my calling to be a clinical psychologist. And so I kind of had to go where the wind blew.
Right. And so I know you allude to some barriers that exist for people of color getting into the world of clinical psychology and finding placements and stuff like that. What do you think are some of the barriers that exist within that space? Like, what are some of the barriers that in which you're alluding to specifically?
Well, I mean, even just to get into the programs, you usually have to have very high GPA, very high test scores. So, you know, if you didn't have the resources to go to an Ivy League school, you're going to be at a disadvantage for getting in the program. If you had other responsibilities, if you had a job or had to take care of family while you were an undergraduate, you might not have been able to get the grades that you need to get into the program. If you didn't have time or money for a tutor for the GRE exams, you might not have gotten the score you needed to get in. And then when you get in, it's full time. You're not allowed to work while you're in the program. You get a stipend that's very small, maybe $1,000, $1,200 a month. You have to find a way to live on that. So if you don't have other resources, that could be really hard. And then once you get in, it's a mentor-based program. So you have to find a faculty member that wants to take you on. And if there's no faculty that are doing what you're interested in, or the faculty aren't interested in what you're interested in, you're not going to be matched. So it really promotes bringing in more people who are just exactly like the faculty who are already in the system.
Right. And these are all barriers that you face at some point or another being in some of these programs?
Yeah, I've had to deal with all of these challenges sort of to get where I am. And I had some advantages and resources too that a lot of people don't have. So I know it's tough to get in. And then once you get in, you know, if you study things like I study, people of color and their experiences, well, that's just not considered as important in a lot of these circles. So it's harder to get published. You know, it's harder to get recognition and appreciation for your work in these spaces. So a lot of people of color, even the ones who do end up in graduate school, they decide not to go into academia because they just found the environment very punishing.
When we think about issues surrounding mental health within the Black community, part of it can be explained by the institutional and systemic racism that exists in our country. The racial discrepancies and barriers that exist for Black mental health practitioners like Dr. Williams is a huge problem that needs to be addressed. One study from the University of Michigan revealed that whites accounted for 67% of students enrolled in health service psychology doctoral programs, while Blacks only accounted for 7%. American universities have a unique opportunity to revamp their admissions process and the amount of financial aid they allocate to their applicants. And this is especially true for the Harvards, Yales, and Stanfords of the world, who all have the endowments and resources needed to alleviate these racial and financial disparities. What are you doing yourself to sort of mitigate some of these things?
Yeah, well, you know, when I am bringing on new students every year, I'm trying to find people who might not have had the opportunity to get into the field otherwise, but have maybe the skills, but maybe just haven't had the opportunities, and who will bring diversity and diverse perspectives into the work we're doing. I mean, it's not a secret that our field is very white and suffers from a lack of diversity. And everybody says, oh, we ought to do something about it. But nobody's actually, I shouldn't say nobody, but, you know, there isn't a big push to actually change things so that these structural barriers are gone so that we can actually diversify. So I do what I can. Most of my students are people of color and sexual minorities and people from maybe stigmatized groups or marginalized religions. And so I'm bringing those folks in so that I can train them so that they can get the opportunities and be part of the discussion on, you know, the future of psychology.
So a lot of your research focuses on PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Could you give my audience a breakdown of what PTSD is exactly? I know some people have an idea, but they might not know the specifics in terms of how it comes into being and ultimately what people's symptoms and experiences are once they've developed this illness.
So PTSD is generally thought of as, you know, a kind of an anxiety-based problem that people have after they've experienced a trauma. So I think, you know, we're all familiar with the idea that someone maybe could be raped or maybe see something horrific in combat. And then after that, you know, have some problems related to anxiety and fear and stress, especially around reminders of those traumas. That's kind of a simplistic view. And we know now, thanks to a lot of research that's been done over the last couple of decades, that PTSD isn't only caused by rape and war exposure. It can really be caused by anything that happens to a person that sort of turns their world upside down, or that, you know, that they're not expecting, they're not prepared for, they're not equipped to handle. And it's usually not one trauma that causes PTSD. Most people who experience a trauma don't get PTSD, but it's multiple traumas that accumulate and cause PTSD. And then once a person has PTSD, you see these fear and anxiety reactions. You know, they don't feel safe. So their body's sort of revved up. They can't sleep, right? Because if you're asleep, you're not looking for danger. And so people have trouble sleeping. They may use drugs and substances in order to help sleep. And then they may need substances to wake up after the substances they took to sleep. You know, substance abuse is very common among people with PTSD for that reason. Also, people with PTSD tend to withdraw. They stop trusting other people. As a result, interpersonal relationships can really suffer. And people are often angry and irritable when they have PTSD, and they may take it out on the people close to them. So you see a lot of broken families as a result of PTSD. So there's a wide range of symptoms, including depression. And it's often misdiagnosed if people who have suffered from PTSD don't tell their clinicians about the trauma. They may be misdiagnosed with having anxiety or depression or anger issues. So it's always important to look for history of trauma when you're assessing somebody that has these kinds of problems.
My father served in Vietnam, and the PTSD he carried with him from his experiences overseas were disturbing. There were many nights that my father sat pinned against the walls of our apartment, paranoid. And as a 7-year-old, I did everything possible to ensure him that no one was in the apartment, not even the Viet Cong. Shit, I didn't even know who the Viet Cong were. According to the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, it is estimated that about 30% of Vietnam veterans have had PTSD. And I would argue that that number is probably far higher. Why? Because my father never talked about his struggles. And because he never talked about it, he never received treatment. Each Veterans Day, I'm extremely torn. On the one hand, I commend and am grateful for every single person that served our country. But on the other hand, I harbor deep resentment because the lasting damage of my father's time in service is something I still carry into my adulthood. Even though I have these mixed feelings, I often wonder what his thoughts would be on this today, especially in the current climate where there is more dialogue of PTSD. Perhaps he would have gotten the help and treatment he so desperately needed. It isn't easy to share this because I'm sharing something my father wasn't willing to share himself. People have talked amply about the psychological damage and PTSD Vietnam veterans were forced to endure, but not many people talk about the trauma that was passed down to the next generation. Do you find a misdiagnosis or a misdiagnoses to be more prevalent in spaces where there are people of color?
Yeah, so I think that it's pretty widely misdiagnosed, in part because when people are traumatized, they often don't want to talk about their trauma. So they may not talk to their clinicians about their traumatic histories. And so that contributes to it. But I think that people of color they do tend to get diagnosed when they're willing to go in for treatment. And there's a lot of reasons why they may not go for treatment. But I think one way that PTSD is caused that's often overlooked is trauma as a result of racism. And so people of color, a lot of people of color are not getting properly diagnosed with PTSD because their experience of racism isn't considered a trauma, when you and I know perfectly well that racism is traumatic.
So you mentioned there's a lot of people that are really not necessarily open to treatment. What do you think some of the reasons are for that? Like, if you had to sort of break it down into a few reasons why, like, say, for example, people of color might not be as willing to seek treatment? What would that be?
Well, I mean, for one, we know that in communities of color, and this is kind of across the board for all communities of color, there are some strong social taboos against mental illness, and then also sharing your difficulties with people outside of your community. So that creates a barrier right there to getting help, especially if you have to go outside of your community to find a clinician, which is another barrier because, as I explained, there aren't many people of color who are doing this work. You know, we can't get over the hurdles that are needed to become psychologists. And so people of color often have to go to white clinicians and outside their communities, and maybe there aren't even any good mental health centers in their area. So they may have to drive someplace far or go a place they're not comfortable going to see somebody who's not going to be from their, not going to be from their ethnic group. And then once that happens, there's a lot more likelihood that that therapist isn't going to understand or appreciate their lives. So we have problems like the clinician doesn't appreciate their values, may take things that are normal in that community and treat them as if they're psychopathology, as if there's a problem with the person or there's a problem with their culture just because they're different. And then on top of that, clinicians are often making small, unwitting insults. We call them microaggressions against people of color. These are little subtle acts of racism that people often aren't aware that they're doing, but you know that they might land on their clients in a not so great way. And then the person feels insulted or hurt, especially if they're coming in for experiences of racism. They don't want more of that from their therapist. Right. And then they're not going to come back for help.
You refer to microaggressions. And I, as a Black person, I know what a microaggression is. You understand what I'm saying? But yes. Some white people don't realize what it is. In fact, I would say a lot of white people or people that aren't people of color have no idea what a microaggression is. So could you maybe break down or provide some examples for my audience, for any white listeners that really – that it is important for them to understand what a microaggression is? Could you break down and provide some examples of what they could be?
Sure. So microaggressions are basically little subtle snubs or patronizing behavior or insults that a person experiences because they're a person of color, for a racial microaggression. Now, you can have other kinds of microaggressions too, gender microaggressions, LGBTQ microaggressions, microaggressions against somebody because of their religious group. But racial microaggressions, they were first identified or described by Dr. Chester Pierce, who was an African-American psychiatrist back in the 70s. And he was a professor at Harvard Medical School, and he graduated there. So he was brilliant, brilliant person. And yet when he would teach classes to the medical students, they would come up to him and give him advice on how to teach. They would tell him, oh, maybe you should organize your syllabus this way. Maybe you should organize the chairs in your classroom that way. And they would take kind of liberties with him that were not common to take with faculty, right? But he surmised that because he was a Black man, they felt that it was within their purview to instruct him in this way. And so I remember reading that thinking, oh my gosh, I'm a professor too, and things have not changed.
Right.
Right. So you just don't get the same level of respect or appreciation. And I'm sure if he'd approached any of these students and said, hey, you know what, I really don't need your help on this, they would have been a bit offended. They wouldn't have realized that the way they acted was patronizing and insulting.
So you talk about, we talk about PTSD. What are some of the treatment types or therapies that are out there to treat them, to treat the condition? And what are the therapies that are you finding to be most effective?
So, you know, a lot of people take medicines for PTSD. There is one approved medicine for PTSD, Zoloft. And then in the state of Connecticut, where I was before here, cannabis was also approved for PTSD. And these can help relieve some of the symptoms to a degree, but they're not a cure for PTSD. And they don't even really work that well in everybody. So So really the most effective treatments are therapies, exposure-based therapies, where the person is confronting the things they're afraid of head-on with the therapist. It's a very hard treatment, and a lot of clients find it difficult, or they don't feel able to engage in a type of treatment where they're going to have to revisit their traumas in a lot of detail. Works very well if people will do it. So that's a problem. So one of the treatments that I think is very promising is MDMA for PTSD. And as you know, there have been some clinical trials going on, sponsored by MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And they are bringing, they're doing clinical trials. They're bringing MDMA as a medicine to the market for PTSD. And it has to be done in conjunction with therapy. So it's not just like you take this rainbow colored pill and then, you know, your trauma goes away. It's still quite a process. It's still a lot of work. But I find that clients seem willing and able to engage with their traumas in a way that you just don't usually see with regular therapy. So there's a lot of interest. We get a lot of calls. I get calls every day at my clinic for people who want to get treated for their PTSD with MDMA therapy. I think it can be extremely helpful for people of color in particular. We had a treatment site at the University of Connecticut when I was there at the health center that was focused on bringing this treatment to people of color specifically as part of those clinical trials. And, you know, and we weren't able to complete that study because of a lot of the institutional barriers that we ran into. But the work that we did there, I thought really really was important and showed the potential of MDMA treatment for people of color. And so I think it can be super helpful, but it's really important that you have a therapist that knows what they're doing, because when people are under the influence of MDMA, they're very vulnerable. And there has to be a lot of trust between the clinician and the client in order for it to be effective. And so if you have somebody who's a person of color, maybe part of their trauma is racism, and you have a clinician that doesn't understand this or doesn't know how to work with that, or doesn't know how to work with any other cultural material that may arise, the treatment will not be as effective. And it could even be harmful if the therapist is actually committing microaggressions against their client when they're in this vulnerable state. So I think there's a huge potential for it to be beneficial, and there's a huge potential for harm, which is why it's been one of my priorities to bring more people of color into this work, so that when MDMA is legal, we have clinicians of color who are ready to go into our communities and help our people.
Similar to Dr. Williams, I am in no position to endorse or encourage Black participation in clinical trials, because the history of negligence and mistreatment is too deep. Nevertheless, the National Institutes of Health found that minorities make up less than 10% of clinical trial participants. This number makes sense when you consider the limited amount of Black mental health practitioners. The consequences of this are significant, however. If participation from people of color is limited, then this means both pharmaceutical companies and mental health professionals' knowledge of how to treat mental illness across racial and ethnic demographics is limited as well. There is already enough guessing that goes into treating mental health conditions, and it's plausible to presume that people of color are more susceptible to this than their white counterparts. As an incentive, people are often compensated for their participation in clinical trials, and even though the compensation isn't changing anyone's financial status, it does seem problematic. I considered partaking in a clinical trial this summer for people with bipolar disorder. My initial thinking was that if my participation could help doctors potentially help people like myself, then I should do it. The money allocated to patients participating was $300, which was not going to change my financial bracket one bit. But for the family or person living below the poverty line, $300 could be the difference between having food on the table or keeping the lights on. My point is that doctors must build a rapport and trust that will make people of color want to willingly participate in clinical trials. Not for a dollar, but for the desire to improve treatment for people like themselves.
How do you gain the trust of people of color in this psychedelic space, where I think the perception of psychedelics from particularly like African Americans in the U.S., is that those are drugs that will, you know, twist your mind up and your brain will never be the same.
Right. So this was something that we really learned quite a lot about doing our research study, because on top of the fact that we're giving, psychedelic drugs to vulnerable people of color, we're also doing as part of a research study. And there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of hard feelings around research in the Black community for reasons that I don't need to really go into, but research community has abused and misused people of color for a long time for their research. So that was another hurdle. And so it was really important to build trust between our research team and the communities and the individuals, to be very transparent about what we're doing. And most importantly, our team was almost exclusively people of color. So it wasn't like, you know, the white guy in the white lab coat is saying, take this magic pill. We're doing this work because we believe in it and we care about the people we're working with. And we hope that they see that we care and that we're not looking to exploit people. We're bringing this medicine to the community because we really think that it will work. And we've seen that it's been working and helping white people for decades, and people of color haven't had a chance to partake of it. And so we want to actually give this opportunity to people of color that hasn't been extended to them. And I have to tell you, there is a long, sad history behind this when it comes particularly to the Black community. We recently did a training for therapists of color in Kentucky. And Sarah Reed, who was doing a lot of the outreach, was running into just what you're saying. A lot of Black people saying, oh, well, those medicines, they're gonna damage your brain and break your mind. And, you know, and a lot of, you know, this idea that people of color will be harmed. And in doing a little research to determine where that came from, I came across some research that had been done in the 60s and 70s at a research institution at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, where they actually were dosing Black men with high doses of LSD. These were men who it was very questionable if they could consent, because they were incarcerated due to drug offenses. And they were given LSD, some of them very high doses over a long period of time, to determine what the human limits were for the drug. And so, yeah, I'm sure a lot of their brains ended up broken from that. And it's no wonder that there's suspicion in the Black community as well as there should be for people doing research in those communities.
I want to get back to like some of the treatments that you were talking about. So I know I read a little bit about like prolonged exposure therapy and somebody, if you could break down what some of the therapies are and what they consist of, that would be so appreciated.
Yeah, well, a lot of my expertise is around prolonged exposure therapy, which is got the strongest evidence base behind it for successful treatment of PTSD, but it's not an easy treatment. So the first few sessions, it's a protocol of about 13 sessions. The first few sessions are dedicated to education about PTSD and how avoiding reminders of the trauma perpetuate the trauma and keep people afraid, make their world smaller, and isolate them from other people. And so the solution is then to confront your fears. And one of the biggest fears that people with PTSD have is of the memory. Now, the memory is not dangerous. It's just a memory. The event was dangerous, but the memory is safe. And so people are gently encouraged to revisit their trauma. They have to revisit the trauma in detail, a lot of detail, as much detail as they can remember, and tell that story over and over again to the therapist. And that's hard. It's scary. It's upsetting. And then the therapist will actually make a recording of the person's trauma narrative and give the recording to the client, who will then listen to that for an hour a day in between their weekly sessions. And then they'll come and they'll tell their story again the next session. They'll do it all over again, make a new recording, add new things they remembered to the story. And this goes on and on and on. And so eventually the person loses their fear of the memory, and they can tell the story without the anxiety and distress that they had before. Now, certainly it's never going to be a happy memory, but it doesn't control them the way it used to. And when they're reminded of it, it's like, oh yeah, it's that bad thing, but they're not shaking or crying or hiding. You know, it kind of really loses its power. So that's prolonged exposure. And like I said, it works well, but it's tough on the clients, and it's tough on therapists too, particularly when people are talking in detail about these horrible things that have happened to them. Just horrible. Sometimes we see therapists with vicarious trauma as a result of hearing these stories. And so the therapist needs support too, to really do this work with the clients.
We talk a lot about white medical and mental health practitioners and a lack of cultural competence. But what are some of the things that white practitioners can do to help sort of alleviate or build trust or improve their level of cultural competence when dealing with these populations?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, I think most white practitioners want to do right by all their clients. And at the same time, I think sometimes we make excuses for them. Because if you, for example, were going to a foreign country and you were driving, it would be on you to learn the rules of the road so you could drive safely. In the same way, white therapists, it's on them to learn what they need to learn to work effectively with people of color, and not just assume the way they did it in their own group is good enough for other groups. We have a lot of information now about the importance of cultural competence and culturally informed care. And really, it's kind of unacceptable that so many therapists have not taken the time or effort to learn how to work effectively across differences. So kind of put that out there first, even though they may not mean well, if they haven't actually done anything to improve their skills, they're part of the problem and they're causing harm, and they need to be held responsible for that. And the information that is needed for them to improve is freely available. And I actually just wrote a few books on this topic. I teach and train therapists, graduate student clinician. And I wrote a book called Eliminating Mental Health Disparities. It's an edited volume that has chapters on a lot of different important aspects of delivering culturally informed care. And I also recently, I'm just finishing up a book on managing microaggressions for clinicians. So they need to educate themselves. And another good opportunity is there are like a lot of like anti-racism groups that people can join and have discussions and learn more. And also people can seek supervision from senior clinicians of color who can help clinicians who have clients of color be more effective with them. So there's a lot of things that clinicians can and should be doing in order to increase their skill set.
A lot of the work and things that you've been a strong proponent of one of the big things that you've been a strong proponent of is addressing race and racism in therapy.
Yes.
And so I have two questions around that. What does that do for a client that might have that experience? And then two, what can practitioners do? Are there like specific prompts or things that they should try to exercise or employ in those sessions that could be particularly effective?
Yeah, I mean, I have to explain that what the therapists need to do is really, really basic and really hard for a lot of white people to do. And the first thing you have to do is actually have a conversation about race with your client. And a lot of white people don't know how to do that. And so they have no practice doing it in real life, and they have no practice doing it in therapy. So when their clients of color bring up racial issues, they don't know what to do with it. So they change the subject or they avoid. And then obviously that makes the clients feel that their concerns are not taken seriously, or they think, well, maybe that means that their therapist is a racist, or that, you know, or that they're, that these issues aren't relevant and shouldn't be discussed, right? So one of the first assignments that I have my students do in my class is that for homework, they have to have a conversation with somebody who is a different racial background than they are about their experience of being racialized, about their race. And you would be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be, on how many students really show a lot of resistance to doing that assignment. I've even had some students say this was completely inappropriate and they didn't think they should have to do it. And they talked to their friends and their friends said it wasn't appropriate and they just didn't want to do it. So I said, wow, this is the beginning assignment. It only gets harder from here. So you better go have that conversation.
Wow. I like just hearing that. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm sorry. Excuse my language. Yeah, like got some nerve. I'm sorry.
So we talk about like preparing African Americans for different types of treatment. What I know to be a particularly big barrier is that a lot of African Americans aren't included or are not willing or don't have access to clinical trials. So a lot of the treatment surrounding some of these mental health conditions, they're not adequately represented in. So we don't really know what's effective or not effective for the African American that's, you know, confronted by some of these conditions. So I'm wondering if you can speak to things that you would recommend as pathways to getting more African Americans involved in clinical trials.
Yeah, right. I mean, and honestly, I can't sit here and say, okay, Black people everywhere go enroll in clinical trials because they need you and there aren't enough of us and we're not well represented. This is true. But I, you know, a lot of the same prejudices and biases and hazards and problems that happened back during Tuskegee are still around today. So I think it would be naive to think that, you know, just because we're now here in 2019, that every researcher has your best interest in mind. And so I would say consider it and be cautious too. I would say look to see who is involved in that research and are there people who are running the study who understand and appreciate racial ethnic issues. And if there aren't, then I would say, you know, it's going to be a risk because we don't know that they have your best interest in mind.
What do you see as the next phase or the next wave of particularly addressing mental health conditions in spaces where there are people of color?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've got several studies underway right now. One study we're just completing data collection for is looking at people of color and their use of psychedelics to cope with racial trauma and how that has been helpful for them or not. So that's one study. We really are just looking at that data now. We're also doing research on racial trauma and how to best measure that in a way that so that more clinicians can more easily determine if their clients have racial trauma. So we're kind of developing tools for clinicians, interviews and questionnaires and things like this. They'll have to be validated before they can, you know, be widely disseminated. And then also looking at the health hazards of microaggressions and also characteristics of people who commit microaggressions. There's been some argument that microaggressions, since they're not really aggressive, they're unintentional, maybe we shouldn't call them aggressions. I don't agree with that because the research hadn't been done to say whether or not they are aggressive. And it's kind of an assumption that they're not aggressive. But I think a lot of us who've been impacted by microaggressions feel that they are aggressive. So we have some new research that's looking at that. And we are finding that microaggressions, committing microaggressions, is correlated to aggressive tendencies in those who commit them. Yeah. So that's exciting.
I don't know if you have any additional anecdotal stuff that you want to share with my audience, but if you do, like, by all means, do so. I would love to hear whatever else you have on your mind.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you had asked about treatments that are effective for people of color for PTSD. And I can tell you, we are doing some exciting new work at my clinic. So I still have a mental health clinic that in Connecticut that I'm the clinical director for. And we just started a program for ketamine treatment. And we we spent several months developing the protocols for it and getting everything in place and everybody trained. And we just finished our first intensive outpatient for ketamine. And this was a woman who had racial trauma, and she did fantastic with the treatment. So we're so excited to be able to offer this now to more people. And we have some people lined up for it.
Could you explain what ketamine is and essentially like what it does to people that are in your trials?
Sure. I mean, well, I'm not a neurobiologist, so I can't, draw a complicated brain diagram for you. But I will say that that it is sort of in that category of substances. It can, at certain doses, cause psychedelic, we might say, experiences. It's been used as an anesthetic, even in children. It's considered very safe. And it's also been used to treat depression. There's been a lot of research on its use for treatment-resistant depression. But for those studies, often the psychedelic effects have been considered an undesirable side effect. And what a lot of us who are interested in the potential of psychedelic therapy have been doing is actually using it as an aid to psychotherapy, where the person takes a dose that would be enough to cause these psychedelic experiences. And then process that material with the therapist that comes up. We call that sort of integration. And people are able to make a lot of progress. I mean, it's not so different from what we would do with MDMA therapy. And there's also trials going on for psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy. And the main idea is that we use the psychedelic substance to put people in a state where they can approach their traumas from different angles. And then reprocess what comes up for them with the therapist and get some healing and resolution that way.
And so when you talk about integrated therapy, that's like people taking some of these psychedelics or these drugs and then essentially like having like a therapy session after that.
Yes, exactly. So for example, with the ketamine treatment, they may come to the clinic. I mean, this is after they get to know the therapist a bit and the therapist understands some of the problems and struggles and that they've been approved by the prescriber, who will then administer the ketamine. And then they may, lay on a comfortable couch with eye shades on. Maybe we have some music for them to listen to for an hour or two. They may talk a little bit during the experience. They may not. And then afterwards, the therapist might say, "So what came up for you?" And then they talk about it. Or they might talk about it the next day. So that's what it might look like.
Who are some of the like practitioners or researchers do you think are at the forefront of doing some of this research mental health practitioners that you think are particularly noteworthy that people should look into a little bit more so?
Oh boy. So that's a big question. Well, I can definitely speak. I can definitely say that the researchers, at MAPS, they're really doing some cutting edge work. Without mentioning any specific names, they've got a great team there. There's also like a great team at Johns Hopkins. In fact, I don't know if you've been following the news. They just opened a big psychedelic research center.
At Johns Hopkins?
At Johns Hopkins, yes. Wow. And they've opened up a smaller center. There's a smaller center that's opened up at the University of Toronto as well for psychedelic studies. So those are some spots where there's folks to watch. Also, I know a number of researchers at Yale who are doing some really cutting edge stuff. I mentioned the psilocybin study for depression. They're also doing studies of MDMA, looking at brain function, and studies of OCD as well. So Yale has got a lot going on too.
I want to thank you for taking the time out to join me and take part in this. So,
you're very welcome. I appreciate it. And thank you for thinking of me. And I hope that, I hope this podcast finds its way to people who need it.
So before we wrap up the episode, I just want to share one resource with everyone. My conversation with Dr. Williams really got me thinking about how the access to mental health doctoral programs is really limited for people of color. And I wanted to think about or try to find a resource that might help make things a little bit more accessible. Not that it would really change the game that much, but if this resource could be useful to anyone, I thought it would be something that would really be good to share. It's a book that the APA published. It's titled Getting In, A Step-by-Step Plan for Gaining Admission to Graduate School in Psychology. And from what I could gather, the book is really useful and helpful in terms of breaking down the admissions process for some of these doctoral programs and schools of psychology. So I would definitely check that resource out if you're somebody out there that's thinking about trying to apply to a graduate school in psychology or doctoral program in psychology. Definitely check out that resource, Getting In, A Step-by-Step Plan for Gaining Admission. I also want to share Dr. Williams's most recent publication. It's a book titled Eliminating Race-Based Mental Health Disparities, Promoting Equity and Culturally Responsive Care Across Settings. And I think a lot of this is rooted in what she and I talked about in terms of building cultural competence and how are people working with people of color and how do we sort of promote equity and do all these things that she is so on the front lines doing in her day-to-day work. Lastly, I want to thank Dr. Williams for joining me on the podcast for this episode. Again, thank you, Dr. Williams. I learned a lot, and I just want to say I really thank all of you for listening. I really do appreciate it. People have been reaching out, talking to me about episodes, things they're thinking about, and it really means the world to me. So I just wanted to share that with everyone. I'm not losing sight of that. Thanks for your continued support, and we'll catch you on the next go round. Peace.